Hey, welcome everybody to the Wonder in Awe podcast. I'm here with my dear friend, Andy Weil. I want to thank the Fetzer Institute for giving us the support to share this information and knowledge globally. Dr. Weil provides valuable information and insight on how to incorporate conventional and complementary medicine practices into one's life. He helps people optimize the body's natural healing power, and he's also hosted his own PBS TV special. In addition, Dr. Weil is the author of 15 books, including the national bestsellers Spontaneous Healing, 8 Weeks to Optimum Health, and Eating Well, Healthy Aging, and my favorite, Spontaneous Happiness. And if we're talking about happiness, then we're in the right place to talk about wonder and awe and gratitude. Welcome, Andy.
Hi, good to be here.
So I know you grew up in Philadelphia in a real urban environment. I grew up in Brooklyn, which was also pretty urban. And I guess both of us were actually in a Jewish household. I'm curious, what attracted you to the natural world?
Well, I grew up in a row house, Louis, so there wasn't much natural world around. There was a small lawn in front and a little backyard. And my mother loved plants, something that she got from her mother, and she gave that to me. And we used that little plot of land in back of the row house to plant all sorts of things. And so I think my first connection to nature was through plants. You know, it wasn't really till I left Philadelphia and actually got out of my school stuff that I began to spend time in nature. I really had never done any camping or hiking or backpacking, but that was a whole world that opened up to me, you know, later probably than some people had.
Yeah. So in Brooklyn, I was in a tenement apartment, obviously, and fire escapes. And I think I really enjoyed racing popsicle sticks in the gutter. It was my white water experience. And it's funny when I go back to Brooklyn and I see the old brick homes and the fire escapes, I actually get a warm homesick feeling in my heart, which is remarkable. Even garbage on the street makes me feel good. So it's wherever you grow up, I guess you're always going to feel those roots.
Yeah.
So when was one of the first times that I think you really experienced the awe and wonder of nature?
You know, it might have been when I first came to the desert here where I now live. I probably was, late 20s, and I came to give a lecture out in Tucson at the University of Arizona. This was 1970, I think. And I remember just being struck dumb by the majesty of the desert. And I think it resonated with, there was a Walt Disney nature film called The Living Desert that I must have seen when I was about 7 years old. And it was filmed here in this stretch of Sonoran Desert outside of Tucson. And when I saw it in person, you know, it was magical, wonderful. And I wanted to get back to that.
The Living Desert and that series, you know, also inspired me. And I think it probably turned me on to, who knows, you know, wanting to do time lapse as well.
Huh.
You know, one of the little secrets about that, the series, is that Disney films were being distributed by RKO. Mm-hmm. RKO did not want to do these nature films. And so Walt decided he wanted to do it. And he said, screw them. We're going to create our own distribution company. And that was the beginning of Buena Vista Distribution.
Huh.
And these films ended up making money. So it's really cool to honor the fact that these nature films is what created the distribution powerhouse network for the Disney Corporation.
I'll tell you one funny little story about that particular film. I got hold of a copy of it maybe 10 years ago, not having seen it in, you know, so many years. The narration was embarrassingly anthropomorphic. I mean, it was really stupid, but the visual stuff was fantastic. And there was a scene of two bobcats fighting, and one of them chased the other to the top of a saguaro cactus. And when I first moved to Tucson, a naturalist who lived here made fun of that scene and said that would never happen in nature. So I was living out in, this was around 1973, I had a house that was way out in the desert, and I was trying to garden there. Gardening in the desert was not so easy. And I was working outside one day, and there was this commotion several feet from me in the desert. It was two bobcats fighting, and one of them chased the other one up to the top of a saguaro. And the one above was, they were trading punches, and they ran down and off into the desert. So nature imitating art. It's great.
I'm glad it was natural behavior, because I heard
it was.
They had another one on squirrels called Perry the Squirrel. I heard they went through 100 squirrels to make that movie. Yeah, they have like a little shoot. Although the squirrel's going to run into a bobcat or a rattlesnake or something.
Very funny.
And there's a lot of trial and error, I think, in capturing these shots. You know,
it must be. Yeah.
Yeah, but they have a lot of squirrels as a backup, and they all look alike. So it worked out. I remember you told me you took this incredible trip to South America. Mm-hmm. I think right after, you graduated from Harvard. What inspired you to take that journey? And, you know, tell me, like, why your curiosity in indigenous cultures and sacred plants inspired you.
Yeah, I majored in botany at Harvard as an undergraduate, and then went to Harvard Medical School. And my mentor as an undergraduate was Richard Schultes, the director of the Harvard Botanical Museum, now considered the father of modern ethnobotany. He had spent a great deal of time in the Amazon in South America, and he urged me to go down there. And I was interested in medicinal plants and psychoactive plants. So he really urged me to go down there and make that trip. This also resonated with something from my childhood. I remember reading, or my mother read to me, a book that had illustrations, and it was about other cultures. And there were scenes from South America, from the mountains, and there were all these references to the Andes Mountains. So I thought they were my mountains. You know, they were Andes Mountains. So I had a real pull there. But anyway, I got a fellowship that funded me to travel around. I actually drove by myself to South America, which was quite an adventure. And then I was there mostly on and off for 3 years, and studying with indigenous people, looking for medicinal plants, psychoactive plants, checking out all the food. I mean, I had a real resonance with Latin America, especially with Colombia, where I spent a great deal of time. And so that was quite a stretch for me, from a kid from a row house in Philadelphia, to go off and do that. But it was very formative.
Why do you think you were so curious about not only, I'm sure, like studying, you know, psychoactive plants there as an observer? I'm assuming you might have also participated.
I was a participant observer.
And so did that trigger something, a spiritual portal that perhaps you never had before?
Well, I am a deeply curious person, and I was from the time I was a young child. And my parents, to their credit, encouraged me to be curious and to follow my curiosity. So, you know, I explored, I've been careful, and I think I've had good guardian angels, and I've been in tricky situations, but I've always come out all right. And I think, yes, in those years when I spent a lot of time alone, I was traveling in strange places. I did indeed take a number of psychoactive plants and preparations, and I think that was the beginning of my opening to, if you want to call it, spirituality or being aware of another dimension that I had ignored earlier in my life.
Yeah, I'm sure we both grew up with Judaism being a little bit devoid of that. You know, I was speaking with a rabbi, a female rabbi in Massachusetts last week, who told me that there's like a bit of a movement with younger Jewish people, you know, that are incorporating psychedelics and the mysticism of the Jewish religion. And I said, well, why was that like so devoid in my generation growing up?
Yeah, well, yeah, I grew up, my family belonged to a Reform Jewish congregation. We were not religious. You know, we went to synagogue on high holidays, but right, other than that, not much. I was forced to go to Sunday school, which struck me as absolutely ridiculous. And I remember hearing about the Kabbalah, and mm-hmm, I tried to get information on it. And, you know, the Jewish education I was exposed to avoided all of that. That was considered a taboo subject. And it seemed to me that was what I wanted to know. If there was a kind of mystical tradition in Judaism, that sounded really interesting to me.
Yeah.
And it was some time before I could, you know, get into that a little bit.
Well, her explanation to me as to why it was so devoid is that I think after the Holocaust, a lot of it got sort of wiped out. But also, I think it was there was an energy from the Jewish community that we have to survive. We got to stick together. They got to create the state of Israel. You have to marry someone that's Jewish. We were almost extinguished. So there was probably a really, gut reaction of do this, do that, follow the rules. Here's the Ten Commandments. Go to Sunday school. I couldn't play Little League. I always resented that to this day. When all my friends went and I was good and I wanted to play baseball, but I couldn't. So I'm grateful that there actually is a resurgence. And if psychedelics can help, inspire it, then I think that's pretty cool.
I do too. And also, I think in me, they created an interest in Eastern religion. And I was very initially drawn to Zen and Buddhist writing. But I found that many ideas from those traditions were very useful to me. And that also resonated with the experiences that I had early on with psychedelics.
It sounds like you probably had an earlier experience before going to South America at Harvard, because you were there at the heyday with
Yeah,
Timothy Leary and Ramdas. I mean, what was that like?
I got to Harvard in the fall of 1960, and that was not yet the 60s. Hadn't happened yet, but it was coming, and a lot of things were going on. First of all, being Schultes' student opened me to a whole world of plant psychedelics because he had studied a lot of these, ayahuasca, psilocybin mushrooms, all of those I learned about from him. At the same time, a block away, Timothy Leary and Dick Alpert were just starting their studies of mostly with psilocybin, some with LSD, and then also young Walter Pahnke, who was at the Harvard Divinity School, was about to do that famous Good Friday experiment. So there was a lot of activity that was happening, and Harvard and Cambridge in those few years, the beginning of the 1960s. That was a real nexus. I think the energy that started there is really what led to the psychedelic renaissance of today.
And Fantastic Fungi is really great. You spoke a little bit about how, let's say, lion's mane could be potentially helpful with Alzheimer's, and that we need a lot more study. So do you think mushrooms in general, let's say, can help, mind, body, and spirit?
I do. I think, the medicinal properties of mushrooms are fascinating, and that has long been ignored in Western medicine. Now gradually, penetrating Western consciousness, that's a really good thing. And a lot of these species have unique effects for which we have nothing comparable in conventional medicine. And the psychedelic mushrooms, I think, are quite special. I just today read a study saying that there's been a little research showing that people who take psychedelics have greater connection to nature and also are more aware of climate change, more involved to get involved in environmental movements and so forth. And it said of the common psychedelics, the one that seems to do this most is psilocybin. And that's really interesting, that because the others are chemically similar and pharmacologically similar, but there seems to be some special property of psilocybin and mushrooms.
It makes sense to me only because I feel like it engenders a feeling of connection to everything, to the trees, to every little molecule, to the ground you're sitting on. And if you feel that connection and you lose that sense of ego, why wouldn't you want to love and protect your relatives that you're surrounded by?
Agree.
Well, that's great. Well, do you think that do you see either yourself or, let's say, the medical profession, whether it's integrative or conventional, making more use of psychedelics to treat people?
Oh, I think it's going to happen. There's enormous demand from my colleagues and from the people that our center at the University of Ireland trains for information about psychedelics. People want to be trained in their use. They want to have access to them. There's a big groundswell toward this, so I think it's inevitable that that's going to happen. And Louis, I also have to say that my early psychedelic experiences profoundly contributed to my philosophy of integrative medicine, especially realization very powerfully that the mind affects the body and that we can change external reality by changing internal reality. And that piece is totally missing from conventional medicine and science. You know, the whole area of mind-body medicine is completely ignored. And it's so useful, and it's something that, you know, I draw on very frequently.
Yeah. Well, isn't what's great book was the biology of belief, but this whole idea about faith, even faith, whether it's religion and also in science, the placebo effect.
Right. I have a little different take on faith from most people. You know, scientific people really find faith very disturbing. You know, it's the idea of believing in something without evidence. But my sense is that faith is a technique that enables you to find evidence. You know, you have to have a willingness to believe that something is possible in order to see it. You know, I've seen so many examples of this in my own life. One that I wrote about was finding four-leaf clovers. And I met people, I remember a woman that I met who would bet you $5 that within a minute, anywhere she was, she could find a four-leaf clover, and she always won. And, you know, I thought, how does she do that? And then, you know, I realized that you start with the belief that the four-leaf clover is there. And until you have that key in your mind, you can't see it. By the way, that's also something that happens with mushrooms that I've written about. When I've tried to learn to find wild mushrooms, often when I first go for a new species, I can't see it. And I'm with people who are seeing them and picking them. And it's very frustrating. And it's not an eye problem. It's a brain problem. You know, the image can fall on your eye, but if you don't have the pattern recognition key in place, you can't see it. You can't recognize it. So I think faith, you know, is a way of enabling you to see something that's out there.
Well, it kind of goes along with that idea that you create your own reality to some degree, you know. I've always been, you know, admire like, you know, sports figures, let's say, that are in the flow. So let's say they're at the free throw line and these guys get a lot of money and they're really good. Why aren't they 100%? Because any kid can make a free throw. And a lot of the success, I believe, is pre-visualization, that they actually can see the ball going through the hoop. I think if you see the ball going off the backboard or something, I think it affects the shot. I think in sports, a good example. And the surfers talk about that all the time, extreme sports. As a matter of fact, a lot of the microdose. And in order to be more in the moment and more in the flow, when they're like inside a curl of a wave or extremes or skiing downhill, you know, and so there's something to, I think, I guess maybe activating the mind with focus, but also pre-visualization as well.
And in terms of wonder and awe, I think the one thing that I've learned from, especially from psychedelic experience, is the extraordinariness of the ordinary. You know, I remember one time, I think this was on LSD a long time ago, lying on the ground, looking at clouds, and the motions of clouds were just amazing, you know, the things that they did, and then realizing this is happening all the time, but I just don't look at it, you know, I don't pay attention to it. And I think that's true of a lot of things in our experience. You know, we live in a completely awesome and wondrous universe, you know, that fact that we're living on the surface of a planet. I mean, how weird is that? But, you know, we it's all ordinary and it's filtered through our habitual lenses. And if you get a chance to like see things as they are, apart from that, everything appears magical and wondrous and awesome.
Absolutely. Well, as my early psychedelic experiences in college certainly influenced my filmmaking. Which is why I'm always altering time and scale, because I find normal to be boring. I mean, the human point of view is your point of view. But what about the point of view of a redwood tree or a hummingbird? You know, obviously, from your perspective, you might say they all have different metabolic rates and therefore they're different time spans on the planet. And therefore, they're moving at different time experiences. Right. But the camera, the fact that I can slow things down and speed things up broadens your horizons to realize that your point of view is a limited point of view, whether it's scientific or cultural, right? Or anything. We have blinders on. And so making the ordinary extraordinary is simply opening up that lens to looking at things differently. And certainly psychedelics has inspired my curiosity to be able to share with people what I've seen. The clouds you talked about, when you watch them in time lapse, you see them metamorphosize. Right. And they don't, they're not changing even in their position in the sky, like going left to right. They're changing and they're staying the same, which always fascinates me, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. this idea of metamorphosis. Yeah, I think it's incredible that it triggers wonder and awe. Do you have a definition for wonder?
I think it's something that challenges the rational mind and your ordinary explanations of things. You know, you wonder at something, it befuddles you in some way, you know, that it strikes you as, you know, the non-ordinariness of it, like, really gets your attention. And, you know, your eyes just widen, Ben. And
I was experiencing it. It's true. It's childlike wonder when you're yep. 4 years old and you ask these yep. questions that are so basic, like, yep. what is air?
Yeah.
What is water? Mm-hmm. You know, and or a child will also become completely fascinated by looking at a flower or a mm-hmm. leaf. Yep. And so it, you know, for me, I think it's approaching something without preconceived notions, mm-hmm. you know, having a blank slate, like that thing of terra incognita,
yep.
which is what I think science tries to do, right? In terms of observation without prejudice and without, you know, assumptions that may or may not be true. If you can be a blank slate, my model and my inspiration in life is like a blank piece of film, huh. you know, just sitting yeah. there in the dark, waiting for light to strike without a preconceived idea of what's going to hit you. Mm-hmm. Wide open.
You know, one of the influential books that I read was Aldous Huxley's Doors of Perception. And that mm-hmm. was right before I arrived at Harvard. And it was one of the things that inspired me to get hold of and take mescaline, which was the first psychedelic that I took. And Huxley took his title from a line of William Blake, which is that if the doors of perception were cleansed, all things would appear to man as they are, infinite.
Wow.
So that's perfect. It's like it's our habitual filters that keep us from seeing the essential, you know, wonderment and awesome nature of everything out there.
Yeah. And I think it's great that science can actually support that idea. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that even with vision, which I'm aware of being a cinematographer, I mean, we only see the visible light spectrum.
Right.
But we know there's energy called X-ray or infrared or ultraviolet, you know, beyond our ability to see. But just because we don't see it doesn't mean it's not out there. And
perceive such a small slice of reality, and it's mm-hmm. it's worth, you know, there are other species perceive other ranges of things, and there's an awful lot out there. So it's always good to keep that in mind, that we're, you know, we're seeing a very small slice. I think these images that are starting to come in from the you know, the new telescope, the James Webb telescope, are yeah. fascinating. I mean, they're every day they come on my you know, Google feed, and they're astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, back in 1950, we thought that the Milky Way was the entire universe. That was it, and that was a big leap. You know,
it was only in the 1930s that people realized that these things that they were calling nebulas out there that they thought were gas clouds were other galaxies. And plus, how about the idea that there are no other planetary systems? I mean, that was very, very recent that people began to admit that maybe other stars had planets around them. I mean, it's amazing that how each, we're so limited by, you know, habits of thinking.
Yeah. So thank God for telescopes and microscopes, that, you know, open up our ability to expand. And maybe that's what psychedelics do, mm-hmm. in a sense, as a tool. Do you have any hypothesis or theories as to why they're able to do that?
You know, Huxley had this idea that there was a reducing valve in the mind that sort of narrowed everything down to make it possible to navigate ordinary reality, and that psychedelics somehow opened that valve and let you perceive more of what was really there. I don't think we really know. I mean, I think we know what receptors they work on in the brain, but I think exactly how that translates into different kinds of perception, I'm not sure we know how that is.
Well, that's certainly worthy of exploration, don't you think?
Totally. And it's also part of the wonder, you know, how these, you know, these molecules evolve. By the way, another one that always struck me is that, you know, why do we have receptors in the brain that fit molecules made by the opium poppy? Or that you go through a whole bunch. Why do we have receptors that fit cannabinoids? You know, it seems to be some deep connection between us and nature. You know, I don't, you can call that coincidence if you want, but it's very interesting.
Well, it goes back to the first thing we talked about, the study you said that showed that people who take psychedelics have a deeper connection to nature. So possibly these plants are trying to speak to us.
Absolutely.
And say, can you live in harmony with the planet?
Mm-hmm.
You know, look, come on, like, help me help you.
You know? I like it.
Yeah, I mean, because it can't be random.
Right.
It can't. It's too, I think, mathematically impossible, right, for a molecular, whatever you call it, formation that fits a receptor. It's like a key in a lock.
Right.
That's very specific.
Yeah.
One of my favorite books you did is Spontaneous Happiness, and I mean, I'm glad it was a huge success. I really appreciate, actually, I should say I'm grateful, the fact that you had my gratitude video in there as a DVD, you know? It's only taken probably more than a decade for me to finally execute my vision of making a movie about it, you know? Why do you think it struck such a powerful chord with the public?
Well, you know, what I wrote about in that book is that, first of all, that I think conventional psychiatry is bankrupt. You know, of all the medical specialties, it's ironic that that's the one that has become most mired in materialism and most restrictive. Is that the word psychiatry comes from Greek roots that means soul doctoring. I mean, what a wonderful concept. But, you know, in modern psychiatry sees all emotional disturbances as arising from disturbances of brain biochemistry, and the only way to treat them is by giving medication to correct that. If you look through psychiatric journals at the ads for the pharmaceuticals, you'd think there would be no mental illness anymore, that there'd be no depression, no anxiety. And that's not how it is. There's more of that than ever. And, you know, our conventional treatments just don't work that well. And when I was doing research for that book, you know, I was looking at all the possibilities that are out there for improving emotional wellness, starting with things you can do on a physical level, things you can do on a mental level, and things you can do on a spiritual level. And in that last section, I became aware of, and this I had not known, of the research that had been done on gratitude. And such a simple thing could have such profound effects, you know, just writing down something that you're grateful for at the end of the day, and that can produce lasting effects on improving your mood. I mean, I had no idea that. So I began incorporating that more in my own life and talking about it to others. And so I was very delighted when that was something that you were focusing on.
Yeah. Well, at UCSD, I think they had a study with coronary patients that journaled that had, you know, significant improvements. And actually I'm doing a study now at UCSD combining my imagery with aromatherapy to help heart patients as well.
Great.
I could probably use a little help myself from being a bit of a workaholic. So yeah, it is remarkable. It truly is remarkable that, you know, I think it's pretty hard to have a negative thought and a positive thought in your head at the same time.
Right. Yep.
And so therefore, just by having something you can be grateful for, you're instantly switching, you know, your vibration into something more positive. It could be as simple as that I'm breathing, right? That I'm talking to you and that I'm moving my fingers. Whatever it might be, stops the rumination, right? That negative cycle of going. And so I'm not sure it's the antidote to everything that's going wrong in the world today, like everything from, you know, environmental degradation, getting out of COVID, the political discourse.
Yep.
But it's a baby step, perhaps, in the right direction.
But it's also, it's so simple, and it's, you know, there's no reason not to do it, and there's demonstrated great effect. You know, another one that I came across in doing research for that book is there's been a lot of research showing that moods are contagious. And they, you can track their movement through populations just the way you can track the spread of infectious disease. And if for example, if you live within a half mile of a friend who is happy, your chances of being happy are, that we can put a particular percentage on it, and the effect falls off if the distance increases beyond a certain point. So that should make you careful about who you spend time with. You know, right. If you want to be in a more positive mood, don't spend time around people who bring you down. That's just a simple one.
Yeah. It's tough because I get addicted to watching the news and political science and so I'm trying to be more disciplined about that personally, because I care about what's going on in the world. Obviously, we have to, I think, be aware.
So it's a balance.
But it's easy to get sucked in to this whole kind of era we're living in right now.
Yep.
What is, I'm going to throw you another curveball, Andy.
Yeah.
What's your definition of beauty?
Oh, I think I've been asked that before. I think beauty reflects an inner harmony and comfort with oneself. I see people who are not conventionally beautiful in terms of the arrangement of their features and so forth, but who to me are beautiful. And it has to do with some, you know, inner quality that they have. And I think it's something that radiates out from something inside them.
But I agree with that. But somehow you, as the observer, are also picking up on that, correct? So who taught you or taught any of us what is beauty?
Well, I think, you know, we're certainly influenced by the media. You know, there are conventional ideas of beauty, although to me that some of them, you know, are not the same as my ideas. I've been very drawn to the aesthetics of Japan and that whole cultural idea of wabi-sabi, things that are rough and unfinished and not conventionally beautiful, but, you know, that kind of stuff really appeals to me, whether it's in pottery or design, you know, things that not polished, not the kind of stuff you see in slick, you know, beauty magazines.
I agree. I was just introduced to kintsugi, which is like, you know, pottery that's broken or have cracks.
Right, right.
And because it's got cracks, it's about healing, right? And making it better. And that there's a beauty in that.
So same in old people. You know, when I was looking at healthy aging, I made a number of trips to Okinawa, which at the time that I was doing it had the highest concentration of centenarians. And I saw a lot of these people who were over 100, and, you know, faces were lined and cracked, and some of them were stooped. They didn't use Botox. And but they had an inner beauty and radiance about them that was very striking. And I think it was because they were happy and grateful that the culture they lived in valued them.
And you're one of the blue zones, right?
Right.
That I think was studied.
Yeah, one of the stories that I collected over there was that a common cause of sibling fighting in traditional Okinawan society was over who is going to get to take care of the aging parents. That's a little different from what we see here, you know, where we want them out of the way. And I think that's a real problem in our society, and it makes it a real challenge for people as they age to maintain, you know, positive outlook and social connectedness and so forth.
Community. That's like one of the common threads of all the blue zones. And loneliness is a killer. Obviously, it's the opposite of that. One of the things I also learned when I read the book about the blue zones is that they tend to, when they wake up in the morning, tend their garden as one of the first things they do before breakfast. And one of my practices is I go to my studio and check out my time-lapse flower. Did it open it? Is it in focus? Is it alive? You know, and I do that before I do tea or coffee or anything because I'm curious and I feel like it might need my help. I may need to refocus, recompose, add water, do something to tend the garden. And by tending the garden, you reconnect yourself to the cycles of nature.
I do the same, Louis. I also have a lot of plants in my home, and I'm very tuned into them, you know, and I check on them every day.
Yeah.
You know, see how they're feeling, what they need, and so forth.
If I'm ready to go to bed, I see a plant that looks a little bit droopy, and then it's like, I can't go to bed unless I can go downstairs, get water, and water it.
Yeah. I mean, I do that in other people's houses, too. I get into some houses, and there's a plant that just calls out to me. It's suffering, and I say, when did you last water that? Or, you know, that needs a new pot. You know, they speak to me. And also, I'm fortunate to have two wonderful companion animals, my dogs, one of whom is asleep on the couch back there.
Yeah.
And I check with them as soon as I get up in the morning. And I'm very grateful for their company. And I assume they are grateful for having me around, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Tuning into other living things, having, you know, relationships. Especially with other things that aren't humans, I think is really important. Plants and animals.
Yeah.
Completely agree. I'm a slave on the weekend to my tiny garden, you know.
That's great.
But everywhere I go, no, but they speak to me. It's like, I need to be watered. I need to be trimmed. I need to be transplanted.
Yeah.
And I get a gentle exercise all day long because it never stops. It's like the whole day goes by and I'm just fixing this and doing that and do this and do that. And I'm honored to be a slave in a way, you know, because I don't have to do any heavy intellectual thinking. It's a meditation in a way, because the functional consciousness of watering something or trimming something doesn't take a lot of energy, you know.
Right.
And I can just, you know, it's peaceful. It's pretty cool.
And the results are so satisfying. You can see, you know, you can see the effects of your, of the energy.
Well, you've got a beautiful garden. I've seen your gardens. They're beautiful. Yeah. You know what it's like? What you're doing is a time-lapse painting.
Uh-huh.
Because whatever you're doing, you don't see in the moment.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I do the same thing. I go, it looks ugly when you prune it. But you know that it's going to shape up in a certain direction and fill that gap. And when you put that little thing in there where there's a space, it doesn't look good when you do it. And then you have to be patient, right?
Yeah.
And wait until spring or something, especially with cactus, I bet.
Well,
you got to wait a long time.
One thing that I got from my mother that we used to do when I was pretty little was plant bulbs, you know, with like narcissus, flowering narcissus. And to me, that was complete magic. The idea that this, you know, this thing would come out of the bulb and make something beautiful. I love fireworks. I'm entranced by them. And it seems to me that bulbs, flowering bulbs, are like fireworks in slow motion.
Right.
You know, like, and the way that they do it, a few months ago, got a whole bunch of hyacinth bulbs and planted them in pots, put them in a shed outside. You know, when nothing happens for a long time, and then they begin to sprout. And the first ones I've just brought in the house, and the
smell—it's
joy. And I give them out as presents to people, and it's like spring. You know, it's like it's spring in your house, like a month before spring arrives.
Well,
can I go get one? Can you take a minute?
Yeah,
I'll be right back.
Yeah, do that.
So this just started to bloom.
Oh wow!
And I planted the bulbs, I think, about maybe 6 weeks ago. And the smell, I wish I could send the smell to you over the screen. I mean, it's just heavenly. And talk about wonder and awe. I mean, it's amazing that nature can do this.
I know. And all that information is in the little bulb.
In the little bulb. And the entire flower is actually inside the bulb in miniature, you know, and then comes out. Astonishing.
Incredible. Astonishing. So I really love your quote that we don't have a healthcare system in the U.S. We have a disease management system.
Yeah.
I mean, do you see that changing as integrative medicine becomes more accepted?
Yeah, it'll have to change because it's economically unworkable. You know, we're now spending something like 18% of our gross domestic product on healthcare, more by a long shot than any other nation in the world. And we have worse health outcomes than most other developed countries. It's going to sink us. And there was just an article I read in the New York Times about doctor burnout. And they're not burned out from overwork. They're burned out because they're victims of this broken healthcare system. So it is completely right. dysfunctional. There's enormous dissatisfaction of both patients and doctors. I think the whole thing is going to collapse. And the great promise of integrative medicine is that it can improve outcomes and lower costs. It can do that first by shifting all this from disease management to health promotion and disease prevention, and then by bringing into the mainstream treatments that aren't dependent on costly technology. So I think that's the future. It's going to happen. And, you know, it is making great inroads into mainstream academic medicine at the moment.
Well, thank you for being a pioneer in that space and for believing in the fact that everything is integrated, right?
Yep.
That's what you see when you observe nature.
And that nature is the source of healing. You know, something I never learned in my medical education, but that's an idea that goes back to Hippocrates in the 5th century BC. He said to revere the healing power of nature.
And we don't have these like silos where everything is separated, right?
Right.
Whether it's mind, body, or spirit, or the ecosystem of the forest in relationship to the fungi, relationship to birds, it's all blended because mm-hmm. they all really overlap each other. Yep. So this word integrative medicine really resonates with me as well.
And I've always said that one day we'll be able to drop the word integrative. You know, it'll just be good medicine.
That's great. Great. Yeah. All right, Andy. Well, thank you for having this conversation with me.
Yeah,
I really appreciate it. I wanted to thank Professor for helping us do this podcast and my team, Sarah and Courtney and Sam and Annie for helping the podcast get produced and edited. Deepest thanks to you, Andy. Keep, you know, you're like a youngster. I think you're still inventing new ways to heal the world.
Still curious.
Oh, good. Curious with wonder and awe, right?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Andy. Brought to you by the Fetzer Institute, helping to build a spiritual foundation for a loving world.